I'm going to begin this tape by relating an event which was perhaps the most exciting episode of my year and a half in New Guinea. Towards the end of January 1942, Snuffy Smith and I one day drove over to the 43rd Bomb Group, B-17s, to visit old Charlie Smith. Well, it turned out that Charlie was going to go on a bombing mission that night up to Rabaul. That's R-A-B-A-U-L. And he asked me if I wanted to go along. Well, I most certainly did. Either Smitty wasn't invited or he didn't want to go. I don't know which, but he didn't. He went on home and left me there. Rabaul was a rather large town, even at that time, up at the far end of an island called New Britain. Very large island. And was a couple hundred miles from Port Moresby, and it involved a flight of a couple hundred miles, perhaps, over water to get there. It was also a hornet's nest and a very large Japanese base, and received a great deal of attention from the 5th Air Force. From the earliest days, I suppose. On this occasion, they were going to send up a bunch of B-17s in string, and that means one behind the other at about, I forget what, perhaps 5 or 10 minute intervals. There were not, I believe, very many airplanes involved in this whole mission, perhaps 10 or 12 or something like that. I doubt if there were more. And it was to be a night mission, and half of the B-17s were to go up there and at what they called a high level, high altitude, which would have made people in England in the 8th Air Force laugh, because by high altitude they meant, in this case anyway, around 7,000 feet. If I remember correctly. The other half were going up at low altitude and were going to skip bomb ships in the harbor. This meant that they would fly across the harbor at masthead level and drop their bombs one by one. The bombs, if dropped correctly, would hit on the water and then skip along the surface of the water and hopefully slam into the side of a ship. It worked pretty well as a technique. So that was the setup. Well, we took off after dark, alone, of course, because there were a couple others in front of us and would follow more behind us. And the pilot was a captain, I forget his name, but Charlie was the co-pilot, and we had a full crew, which meant a bombardier, a navigator, the crew chief, who was the top turret gunner. We had a belly turret gunner, I suppose, tail gunner, two waist gunners. Whether they had a radio man or not, I'm not sure, but I think we did. It doesn't make any difference. Of course, I had ridden once before in a B-17, but this was a real sure enough combat mission, and the first time I'd been exposed to a genuine bombing mission. We took off and flew east along the coast of south coast of New Guinea for I don't know how far, 50 miles perhaps, and then made about a 90-degree left turn and headed straight north across New Guinea, and then across the open water, on up to the far end of New Britain. The Rabaul was located at the far end, and because the island of New Britain lies roughly northeast-southwest, we wouldn't come over land until we had practically reached our objective. When we got out over the open sea, incidentally, it was a moonlight night, like full moon, and you could see very well. The gunners asked permission to test their guns. They always waited till they got over open water, if that was possible. And, of course, permission was given. And much to my surprise, whenever those 50 caliber machine guns were fired, you could feel it all over the airplane. It never occurred to me that a thing like a 50 caliber machine gun would be perceptible in an airplane that big, but it was. And you could see some of this because, of course, there were tracers loaded in with the rest of the ammunition. Incidentally, I don't know how those bomber people loaded their ammunition. The way ammunition was loaded in P-40s and the other fighter planes was what we call 2-2-1. And that meant that you had two armor-piercing bullets, followed by two incendiary bullets, followed by one tracer. And then it would repeat again, two armor-piercing, two incendiary, one tracer. I don't know what arrangement the bomber people used, but they had tracers in there, and you could see them arcing out over the water as they tested the guns. Well, it was all very nice, and Captain, whoever he was, the pilot, kept messing around with the automatic pilot, and it didn't seem to be working quite right, but he did, and we had this beautiful trip out over the sea in the moonlight and so on, and eventually, way ahead, you could see the outline of the coast of New Britain looming up, and it was all in darkness. I was standing up in the cockpit, standing between the pilot and the co-pilot, and looking out the front windshield. And about the time we sighted the coast, we also saw a great deal of anti-aircraft fire going up. Of course, all you could see at night or at any time was the tracer bullets. But there was a lot of that. They poured up into the air, just rivers of the stuff, it looked like. Very pretty indeed. And what that meant was that the Japanese at Rabaul were firing on the airplane that had taken off in front of us. And so we were still quite some distance away. And this lasted for a couple of minutes only and then died down to absolutely nothing, just pitch dark as far as the ground was concerned. And, of course, that meant that the B-17 in front of us had gone over his target and had left and was starting back home. The way this was supposed to work, we were flying, let's say, due north. So we were going to turn 90 degrees inland to the west, in other words, down the coast a little bit from Rabaul, fly inland for 2 or 3 minutes, and then make a big lazy U-turn to the right and make a bombing run over the town of Rabaul and over the harbor and drop the bombs on ships in the harbor, we hope. Maybe on the town, I don't know. Anyway, as we got to the coast and stunned, the Japanese had some inkling, apparently, of our presence. But they didn't open up on us all at once. An isolated gun would fire from time to time, and you'd see this tracer going up, just one here and one there, and then nothing, and then one or two, and then nothing. But as we completed our 180-degree right turn, started into the bomb run, they were pretty well convinced, I suppose. They knew where we were, and they probably did, because they all hell opened up. And it just looked like little rivers of fire pouring up from the ground on all sides. And I remember thinking, my God, he's not going to fly this airplane through that stuff, is he? Well, he did. He didn't move a muscle. He just sat there and started in on a course due east, pretty much. Captain turned to me and said, Harry, said, why don't you go back towards the back and open the door into the bomb bay, and you can watch the bombs fall when we release them. I thought that was a fine idea. And so I went back there and opened the door into the bomb bay. And I was so dumb, I don't think I was surprised at all. I opened the door and the bomb bay was completely illuminated brilliantly. And I took this as a matter of course for some reason. And I crouched there and watched, and sure enough, after a few seconds, all the bombs let loose and fell away, and the bomb bay doors closed, and I got up and shut the door into the bomb bay and went back up front, and the whole cockpit was brilliantly lit. What had happened, of course, was that they had caught us in their searchlights. Old Charlie Smith was screaming and hollering, saying, get us out of here, get us out of here, God damn it, get us out of here. Well, Captain so-and-so, to whom this was apparently not a new experience, said he didn't seem much fussed by any of this, and he did a hard, sudden turn to the left and went up on the left wing and dove down some and then straightened out and then turned again back and forth with a series of dives and climbs and turns. And first thing I knew, we were suddenly out in the moonlight, and everything was all dark on the ground and was all quiet. And the pilot told me later, he said, if you keep changing altitude and direction fast enough, he said, they can't keep you in those lights. They can't follow you. And apparently it was so, because they didn't. Well, it was all very peaceful and quiet, and the pilot flew east a little bit and then made a big 360-degree turn to the left, and he said, look out there and see if you see any fires or any indication that we've hit anything. But we didn't see anything except darkness. So we started out home and apparently hadn't received any hits or anything. It was all terribly exciting. Well, we flew on south back to New Guinea, and when about the time we got to the north coast of New Guinea, and we were at a pretty good altitude, I remember the pilot asked the navigator where we were, and the navigator said, I think we're at such and such a place, and the pilot said, God damn you, he said, I don't want you to think, I want to know, he said, I'm low on fuel. And upon that, the navigator said, yes, we definitely were at such and such a spot along the coast. Well, about that same moment, or a few minutes later, when we got towards the mountains, we flew into a thunderstorm, and it had to be the most violent storm I was ever in an airplane. I was standing up behind the pilot and co-pilot and hanging onto something on the roof. I don't know what, probably part of the turret or something, I don't know. But anyway, it was so rough that it almost pulled my hands right loose, and I barely managed to hang on. And it had threw that airplane all over the sky. And the rain came down in buckets. But all this only lasted probably less than a minute. Suddenly, the next thing we knew, we suddenly burst out of the clouds into the moonlight again, and it was all serene and quiet. So we flew on south to the south coast of New Guinea and then turned west and flew along the coast, losing altitude all the way, back up to Port Moresby. During the course of this westward flight, we noticed that the plane that had taken off behind us was also on his way back. We had the wing lights on and all that stuff. And so it was visible, and he had his on. You could see him. And he was quite a distance behind us, but plainly visible. Well, the bombers people apparently had a sort of recognition procedure so that strange airplanes couldn't come in unawares. They had to do a certain flight procedure so that the people on the ground would know they were friendly. And on this occasion, it consisted of flying on up the coast beyond Port Moresby, just to the far side of town, and making a 270-degree left turn around a buoy in the harbor. And then we came on in and landed. The airplane that was behind us did exactly the same thing and also followed us on in, though at some distance apparently, because we landed, they turned on the lights on the field, which meant just the lights that outlined the edges of the runway. And we taxied in and taxied down a taxiway and into a revetment. A revetment, in this case, consisted of a large U-shaped mound of dirt higher than the airplane. And the airplanes were parked in these revetments to protect them from bomb blast damage and from strafing and so on. You would go in there head first and then suddenly hold brake on one wheel and gun the engines on the right-hand side and spin it around 180 degrees until you were headed outward. And that was it, and that's what happened. And stopped the engines. Some people got out. I got out. And about the time I got out, the airplane behind us was apparently coming in to land, and he had his landing lights on and so on. But lo and behold, when he got right over the end of the runway, he doused his lights and the bomb started falling, whoop, 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 as he went down the runway in the air. And, of course, he revved up his engines. They made a big holler suddenly before the propellers took control over the RPMs. And before anybody knew what had happened, he'd gone. And, of course, what happened was that this Japanese bomber had simply followed us in, and we assumed it was the B-17 behind us. Well, it wasn't. Didn't do a lot of damage, didn't hit us, but he hit a transport which burst into flames, and of course the Jap was gone by then, probably laughing heartily to himself. I had always said that nothing would make me lie down in a mud puddle. But I remember on that occasion throwing myself flat into a mud puddle and being very glad to be there. The only funny part about all this was the fact that soon after, the B-17, which had taken off behind us, did actually indeed come back, but nobody trusted him. And he had a very hard time getting them to turn on the lights for him, but they finally got to the point where they'd flash them on and off. And the poor guy had to make the best he could out of that, and he landed and taxied in. Well, that was about the end of this story, except that we went up to some tent where the intelligence people interrogated us, and I remember the captain said, "Come in, Harry, and tell them what you saw through the bomb bay doors." And I did that. It was all very exciting to me. To give you an idea, though, of what some of those people put up with, the B-17s that were going to do low-level skip bombing in the harbor did that. Some of them followed the plane in front of them so closely that they got water sprayed all over the nose of the plane from the bomb exploding from the airplane right in front of them. And one of them made a bad bomb run. He wasn't satisfied with it and didn't think he was going to hit anything. So he just, after going through this craziness, which it seemed to me it was so dangerous, he pulled up and made a big 360-degree turn, came in there and made his second run all over again, hoping to get more satisfactory approach. I suppose he did. Well, that's the end of that story. I spent the night at the 64th Squadron or whatever it was, and next morning Charlie drove me back over to the 7th. I remember that we had at that point a new 49th Fighter Group commanding officer, a young fellow, still in his 20s, a lieutenant colonel by the name of Morrissey. Very nice guy. And he happened to be over at the 7th Squadron when I came back, and he asked me to tell him about this bombing mission I'd been on. Incidentally, somebody told me later that that was forbidden for fighter pilots to go on bombing missions like that. But I didn't know it, and nobody ever said anything to me about it, and Colonel Morrissey didn't say anything. He sat there, I remember, in a chair with tilted back against the wall and sat there listening to this narration. Of course, I was terribly excited and going through all this description. And the colonel just grinned and grinned, but he never said a word that I remember. Anyway, it was all terribly exciting. Nothing as exciting as that ever happened to me again. One day, some of us, Paul Slocum and Snuffy Smith and some others, Don Raines from the 40th Squadron, we went in a jeep, or a couple of jeeps, up to some waterfalls in the mountain outside of Port Moresby. And I don't remember them very well, but I remember they were rather considerable falls, and they had a very nice pool at the bottom and lots of big flat rocks all around. And we just took our clothes off and went swimming and lay in the sun and swam and lay in the sun. It was an extremely pleasant afternoon. I remember that. From time to time, some of us would get in a jeep at night and go over to the 40th Squadron and visit Raines and the other guys that we knew over there. We almost invariably played hearts and always enjoyed that. And they were always very hospitable to us and occasionally even had some liquor. Where they got it, I don't know. Liquor was something that fighter pilots seldom had in New Guinea because there was no way to get it. There wasn't any supplied to us, and we didn't have any way, whereas the bomber people, they always had lots of liquor. And when they'd run out, they'd simply send a bomber down to Sydney or someplace and load it up with whiskey and whatever and bring it back with them. And they were always fat in that respect. But we never had much. The only time we'd get to bring liquor back was if you would go to Australia to ferry back a new airplane. And in those instances, you'd get what liquor you could. Liquor was very hard to get, period. But you'd get what you could and put it in the ammunition bays in the wings. In other words, in the places in the wings that were intended for ammunition, which were empty at that point, of course. And you could put, 8 or 10 liquor bottles in there, I suppose, and get it back. But that was the only way we had of getting liquor. I always wondered what would happen if we were on the way back from a mission like that, a ferry mission with the ammunition bays full of whiskey, and got in a fight and got shot down and and the people in the United States learned about it. I'm sure it would have been a big scandal, but to my knowledge that never happened, nor was it even likely to happen, actually, since nobody was flying it on those occasions anywhere near enemy territory anyway. In order to assemble fighter planes or bombers either, I suppose, any other kind in formation. The procedure was that the first person to take off flew straight off the end of the runway for some distance and then would make a slow climbing turn, generally to the left. The second man to take off did the same thing, but turned left sooner than the man in front of him. In other words, he flew a shorter circle and so cut him off and was able to get into position that way. And each succeeding man that took off did the same thing. Each one would fly straight a little bit and then cut across the circle to join the formation. Otherwise, you would have to use a lot of extra throttle and therefore extra lot of extra fuel in order to get in formation. You did anyway, but this reduced that problem considerably. But inevitably, it was bound to be the case that when Tail End Charlie, namely number 16 man, the last person in the squadron to take off, he had a hard time joining the formation by that time. And on one day, which happened to be February the 13th, I took off to go on a mission, and I was Tail End Charlie that day, the last one to take off. And I did what I always did in a case like that. You'd, as soon as you got above the treetops, you'd level off and then turn as steeply as you dared at the low airspeed and try to get around, make as tight a turn as you could to cut off the rest of the airplanes which were circling to give you a chance to get caught up and join the formation as quickly as you could. A lot of emphasis was placed on how little time you lost in this procedure, and people would get very critical about it if you didn't do this with a minimum of time loss. On this occasion, I had taken off and turned 180 degrees left and was flying along when something, I thought anyway, went wrong with the engine, and I began losing RPMs and therefore power. I didn't have power enough to do any climbing. I didn't dare bail out because I was practically at treetop level as it was. And it was much too low. So I had to make up my mind what to do and make it up fast because time was running out as far as I could see. Well, I did see down below me a sort of clearing in the trees. This spot actually was not very far from 17-mile airstrip. Actually, I was flying parallel to it and south of it a little, but it wasn't far off. Anyway, I decided to belly land the airplane in this little clearing. So I shut off the engine, and I shut off all the switches I could find, and the most important thing was to get rid of the belly tank, which hung under the airplane, and at that point would have been filled with 50 gallons of gasoline, and you didn't want to land on top of that. Well, I must have been scared, and I must have pulled the release thing much harder than I thought, because the whole cable, it was a steel cable with a sort of T-bar on one end, it went down through the floor, and you just put your fingers around the T-bar and yanked on it. Anyway, I must have yanked harder than I thought, because the whole cable, T-bar and all, came right up through the floor. And I remember thinking, therefore, that it had broken and that the belly tank had not dropped. And I remember throwing that cable on the floor and saying, "God damn you, son of a bitch." I remember that. Anyway, I bellied it into this little clearing, and I would have been all right, though I had to land pretty fast because there was hardly any room to get in there. It was in a field of very tall grass. By very tall, it was waist high, I suppose. But unfortunately, hidden in that tall grass were some tree stumps and things, and the one wing hit the stump and spun the airplane around, another hit something else and tore the propeller off and all the cowling that went around the engine. And somewhere in this process, I hit my head against the gun sight, I guess. Hit it against something, anyway. Now, we had, in addition to a seat belt in these airplanes, we had a shoulder harness, two straps which came up over the back of the seat and crossed your chest and anchored in to the seat itself. Most people didn't like to use them and didn't use them because they restricted your movement and chafed your shoulders. There was a sort of release on them that you could use and put them on, and would allow you to lean forward and move around some. And if you thought you were going to crash, then you could move this little lever into the lock position, and then they held you tight. But